It's safe to say that Ricky Ian Gordon loves the human voice. His songs are performed by artists such as Audra McDonald, Renee Fleming, Nathan Gunn, Judy Collins, and Betty Buckley. His first grand opera, The Grapes of Wrath, was a huge success, and Cincinnati Opera presents the world premiere of his latest opera, Morning Star. We are delighted to have Ricky Ian Gordon in the studio.
Hey, and I'm delighted to be here.
Start out by telling us about Morning Star.
Morning Star, well, is a story about a Jewish family on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in 1910, the Felderman family, Becky Felderman. Her husband died in Europe, but she has her youngest son, Jaime, and her three daughters, and they are trying to make their way in New York. They're immigrants in a tenement, tightly cramped together. A friend of hers named Aaron is also living in the tenement with them. It's about love. It's the central event of the opera is the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. It has personal resonance for me because my grandmother, Rebecca Lieberman, my mother's mother, worked at the Triangle Shirt Factory. And on the day of the fire, she was out sick. And her mother dragged her out of bed to go to the factory and see all of her friends flying out of the window in flames. So I believe there will be a photograph of her in the program, which is very deep for me. It's also about the three daughters have, there's a daughter named Fanny, who is a singer, and she meets a man named Irving, who's a songwriter. But of course, the story of the time, Irving, when he marries Fanny, doesn't want her to sing anymore. He wants her to be a mother and a wife. And this is sort of my mother's story. So it was a way for me to, in many ways, tell the story of my own family through Sylvia Regan's play. And I wrote it with the great playwright, librettist, William Hoffman, who wrote Ghosts of Versailles and As Is. And he's done a very unusual, wonderful, quirky libretto, I feel, based on Sylvia Regan's beautiful play. In terms of doing it here, it's a great opportunity because, as you know, we developed it in this opera fusion situation. But the truth is, when I was asked to do something for opera fusion, I did not know what opera fusion was, and I didn't know that it was about normally preparing works that were already scheduled for companies, right? And so I just said, the only way I would do something like that is I'd like to look at something that I feel I want to revisit that isn't done. And that was the story of Morning Star. I had no idea Cincinnati Opera was involved or would even be looking at it. I just thought we would be using their facilities to workshop with students. So the truth is, we had a great time. We threw an atom bomb at the piece we had. We reconstructed it, deconstructed it, put it back together, had this workshop that you were at. And on the night of the workshop, 10 minutes before we're doing it, Evans Mirages shows up and I'm like, Evans, what are you doing here? And he said, Patty Begg said I should come and see this. And that is the only moment where I thought, oh, maybe Cincinnati Opera's interested. But how lovely that I never knew that till that moment. Because if you know that, you're less brave about making a mess. And that's why I did Opera Fusion. I wanted to make a mess. I wanted the freedom to completely revisit, reconstruct, throw away, rewrite. And that's what we did, Anne. That's what I was so grateful. And then, as you know, we got a whole second workshop. So we really worked on the piece. And it's funny because we really worked on the piece after the second workshop up until, I know you came to my Opera 27 at Opera Theatre of St. Louis last summer. When I got back from St. Louis, someone had sent me an archival photograph of the day of that all the mourners with their black umbrellas in the pouring rain, thousands of them, were waiting in line to view the bodies of the women in the shirtwaist factory. And that photo, I had never seen it. It was so powerful that Ron Daniels and I had a conversation. I said, Ron, I think we need a prologue. And we created a prologue. So in essence, really, the fire frames the piece now. Though we don't mention the triangle in the prologue, all we see are these mourners. The photo was in the paper, and the archival, what was written about the photo in the paper, 1910, it was so exquisitely beautiful. We actually used that archival journalism and lyricized it. It is the opening of the opera now.
This is the director that you were talking about.
Ron Daniels, genius. Basically, someone I never knew, never worked with, James Robinson, who's the artistic director of Opera Theatre of St. Louis, told Robin Guarino and Marcus that he thought Ron Daniels would be a good fit for me. And he was amazing. At first, I was really unsure because this man is not codependent. He is not invested in you liking him at all. He just says what he thinks and he says it right away. So he was honest from word one. And then it turned out, what a great thing to have this guy, because you know what? He's brilliant dramaturgically. He really, really was exactly what we needed. He steered the ship, and I'm really grateful to him.
Well, your first breakout success as far as opera was Grapes of Wrath, which was commissioned for Minnesota Opera. And that was a grand opera,
yeah,
really
it was
grand.
Well, it was 2007, so everybody still had money. So it was a three-act, almost four-hour, 60-piece orchestra, huge chorus, many, many cast members. But the next year, no one had money. And that opera has been done in many, many ways, in many, many places, but never, ever exactly as it was done in Minnesota because no one could afford it. And now, I don't even know if you know this, but Opera Theatre of St. Louis just announced that they're commissioning a two-act version for 2017.
So for... In 2 years, they'll be doing that, and that will be a reworking.
It's really a new opera. It's like we're really reconceiving it. As Jim Robinson said, I don't want you to sand it down. I want to rethink it because there already is a version of it. Let's just do a new version of it. So I'm excited about it.
You were here for the Opera Fusion workshop with Bill Hoffman.
Yes.
There's really nothing like Opera Fusion that gives you that kind of opportunity to seriously rework and deconstruct and throw atom bombs at your work. So it was clearly a remarkable experience, but it was also a remarkable experience for the students who worked with you.
That was incredible. I mean, it was incredible for us because we had no choice. We had to be ourselves in the room. We argued, we fought, and we rewrote, and we changed things every day. And for those kids to see that, to really see what goes into creating a work for the theater, because it is no joke. I would go home at night and stay up all night and write an aria and the next day bring it in. One night, what was it? I was home for an entire night and wrote an entire new ensemble called The Women Dream. Remember when we almost did it for the workshop because we were so excited about it, but then it was like, let's not chance it. But a lot of new stuff got written, and it got written in that situation. I do have to tell you, Anne, because this is sort of funny, but Opera Fusion, a lot of why it was born was there was once a big roundtable discussion at Opera America, and it was me and Robin Guarino and Dale Johnson and Diane Paulus and Bart Scher and all these people from different elements of the field, and we all talked about how nobody in the opera world knows how to workshop a new opera. I'm pretty sure because the whole Mellon Foundation was there at that round table, and it was like a 3 or 4 day round table. This came out of it, and I'm so proud to be, because I was quite vocal in those discussions, because really, when we did Grapes of Wrath, God bless those companies, but they didn't know how to workshop anything. It was just like, that happens in the theater. It's new to the opera world to workshop pieces. Completely workshop them, to look at things, to change things. You know, composers a lot of times thought you hand in your score and it's like, that's it, don't change a note. That is not necessarily the greatest way to create a piece of theater, which is collaborative and has to be changed for the stage.
Have you gone back and made changes to any of your previously created works? As you have with certainly with Grapes of Wrath.
Everything, even after the world premiere of Grapes of Wrath. The next city we were going to after Utah, because I didn't have time between Minnesota and Utah, but after Utah, we were going to Pittsburgh. And I wanted to try something because I had read a new book that came out. It was called The Worst Hard Time. And it was a brilliant, I think it won the National Book Award, and it was about the Dust Bowl. And there was suddenly all this new information about dust storms and the Dust Bowl. I said to Michael Corey, Michael, I want to try something. We need more dust in this opera. So we wrote a whole new sequence called Dusty Road, where we combined a lot of the exposition in Act One into a sequence called Dusty Road. Who knows? I don't even know if that's going to be in this version in St. Louis. But that was an example of why not try it? I mean, That's what we can do. You can rewrite until you're dead, and then you let the world decide. I mean, look at how many versions of Don Carlo there are.
You've got some really remarkable young cast members in Morningstar.
Yeah.
They're really amazing. And Twyla Robinson has the role of the bar matriarch.
Yeah.
And then you've also got Morgan Smith.
Yes.
Who's a remarkable baritone.
I love him.
He was in Moby Dick.
Yes.
And he's coming here.
Yes. I asked him to do it. I was in Houston with Morgan. He was working on The Passenger, and I was premiering A Coffin in Egypt with Frederico Vanstada. And Morgan really made an impression on me. I think he's a very deep artist. He's a very connectorist. He's a little young for the role, but he has the voice for the role and the stature. And I feel like the chemistry between him and Twyla will be very, because there should be chemistry between those two. It's like he's always wanted her. And I think on a certain level she wants him, but she's so afraid of defiling the memory of her husband. But you should feel that pull, and I feel we will in that configuration.
In the time we have left, I do want to ask you about your songs, because your songs are so special and so remarkable. And I know you love poetry, and your settings really bring out the music in those texts.
That's nice.
And you have set Joy, one of my favorites, and What the Living Do. So when you create these songs, do you go to the text? What do you look for in a text?
It is really great that you asked that, Anna, because my process of writing a song is I teach it all around the country. I invented my own class. It's for composers, and it's about setting text, and it's called A Gesture on Behalf of the Poem. Let's use What the Living Do as an example. I memorized that poem, and I could say that poem anywhere. I have. I'm like invited to dinner parties in New York, including at Barbara Cook's, to recite poetry. And that poem starts to take life inside of me. And eventually, by the time I make a gesture on that poem's behalf, it's because in some ways I have become the poem and the poem has become me. So for example, Anne, because you love the song, What the Living Do, the gesture was when she says, and yesterday, hurrying along those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, spilling my coffee down my wrist and sleeve. The idea that ultimately that poem is about this inexorable hurrying through life, while what is in the back of everything is remembering everything and everyone we've lost, which makes everything, including buying a hairbrush, resonant, right? So that was the gesture. So for me, you memorize it, and I hear in my head all the time, Johnny, the kitchen sink has been clogged for days. Some utensil probably fell down there. It's the prosody of the poem that I want the poem to be like a jewel in a setting that when you hear it, you not only hear the poem unfold as if someone was reading it, but if I've done my job, I've also told an emotional backstory that will make the poem wash over you like a wave and tell you another story that coincides with that poem, but doesn't upset it, doesn't disturb it, doesn't disappoint.
And you do just that. I was getting chills as you were describing it. So if you don't know Ricky Ian Gordon's songs, they're posted on YouTube. They're available on all the usual sources. And another Ricky Ian Gordon trademark is that he's always sporting a fedora, and today is no exception. You can't see that, and you can't see that I have one, too.
Every once in a while, it's a tam.
That's right, but not today. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be here with us.
Thank you.
It's always a pleasure. Cincinnati Opera presents the world premiere of Morningstar, starting on June 30th and running through July 19th at the School for the Creative and Performing Arts Corbett Theater. You can find out more by going to wvxu.org/AroundCincinnati, all one word. For Around Cincinnati, I'm Ann Arenstein.
Oh, like me.